Quiet. She mustn't die. You understand?
Hiroshima.
Did you hear that?
Yes, the child.
The child? Yes, yes, the child. There's no child here. But the dogs! There's no children or dogs here, no?
Sorry, I'm just reading through this. Der alte Diener. Der Dorfarts.
Der Dorfarts?
Sorry, I read that wrong. Dorfarts. This village doctor. Town doctor.
Dorfarts.
Yep. Dorf.
I still hear Dorfarts.
Yeah, I said that first by accident, Dorfarts. But then I realized Dorfarts. It's Dorfarts.
Dorfarts.
Arts.
Dorf
Village Arts Doctor.
Arts. Dorfarts. Dorfarts.
Yeah. Dorfarts.
Yep, Dorfarts. Well, hello, Jellyheads, and welcome to a spooky episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In. I'm your host, Boris Von Dave, and I'm here with my fiend and co-host.
Miss Wilson.
It's going for more Scooby-Doo thing.
Yeah, the Scooby-Doo witch cackle. I mean, I think everyone can do the Scooby-Doo witch cackle.
Yeah.
Actually, does that predate Scooby-Doo? Does that go all the way back to Snow White and Seven Dwarfs?
I don't know. Maybe. They might just be reusing footage, like sound. You also, like, almost every monster on that show also sounded like...
And by the way, now I think it should be Snow White and the Seven Dwarfarts. But we're going to go on anyways, because what movie are we talking about tonight?
Vampire. Or, Dave, it could be the morning for somebody else listening to the podcast. It could be the afternoon. You don't know.
Time is irrelevant. This is pre-recorded material. Heavily edited.
And why are we watching Vampire?
It's Vampire with a Y. Which...
Why?
We found out there's a video game that came out recently that is spelled the same way.
Yeah. What if it's a video game version of this movie?
I doubt that.
Somebody saw this movie and was like, that needs to be a video game.
I think somebody saw the title of this movie and said, oh yeah, that needs to be a video game title. A weird spell. Video games love weird spellings of words, don't they?
Especially if it's Japanese.
But anyways, that was one of the funny things of searching this and saying, oh, there's a video game. Just tons of stuff on this video game came up. I did not know about this game until then.
Neither did I, and it made it kind of hard to search.
It did. So that's Vampire with a Y, and specify 1932, and Carl Theodor Dreyer.
Carl Theodor Dreyer.
The director who's most famous for Passion of Joan of Arc.
Oh, that movie tried to start immediately after I watched this.
Oh, yeah. If you had on the thing that plays the next video on YouTube.
Yeah.
They call that just continuous play.
Autoplay.
Autoplay, yeah. I actually haven't seen that. I wish we had, like, Evan here. He's probably seen that.
Probably. Why isn't Evan on right now?
I don't know. Evan should be on. Evan should be our third co-host.
But he's not. But he should be. If you only live closer.
Just a little bit closer, you're my kind of man. So, this is the movie he made right after Passion of Joan of Arc, which is considered to be one of the most visually stunning films in film history.
Well, I can believe it after seeing this movie. For something shot in 1932, it's got some cinematic tricks that you wouldn't see used all that much until decades later.
And some of it's very surprising. There's some of it that I kind of attributed to Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah?
Specifically in Rashomon.
What did he make that?
Kurosawa made Rashomon in the 50s. And it's got the shot where the camera's pointed up at the sky and moving through the forest.
Okay.
Now, the difference here is that the camera in that shot is pointed directly at the sun. In Vampire, you have the scene where you have the point of view of the man in the coffin.
Yes.
And the coffin has a little window on it so we can see out. And it's all a dream anyways. it's all a dream sequence.
Is the window thing an anti-vampire thing?
I think that's just kind of one of the things they used to do in some parts of the country a long time ago.
Why were there windows in coffins? What are witch windows?
Oh, those are in houses. Those are just crooked windows.
Oh, yeah, you find them in Vermont.
Yep. But shall I just finish my point?
Yeah, go
about,
on.
Like, the camera is pointed up at the sky and is moving. And it's not moving up, it's moving along the land, right? To Simia, this is the point of view of the guy in the coffin as the coffin's being carried away to be buried. And like I said, it's one of those shots where you see it and you're thinking, because of this movie's age, it's one of those shots where you're like, okay, no one had ever done that before, you know?
Yeah.
And then it takes to like 1950s, so over 20 years later, because I think it was 1955 Rashomon came out, that Akira Kurosawa does a similar shot with the camera pointing at the sun. And it's a character point of view as the character's looking up at the sky, you know. And it creates this weird ambiance that's not necessarily, like, in Rashomon specifically, it feels very non-linear. The only thing linear about it is you watching it, you know. But there are just these scenes in the forest in Rashomon that seem to be like just like this angle and that angle. And it's a little disorienting, and it feels out of time, you know? It's not necessarily this happened and then this happened and then this happened, which is like the normal editing of most movies, unless they like fast repeat some action, you know? But I found more often in foreign films, there's this kind of non-linear editing that happens where there are these scenes or shots that are supposed to like happen simultaneously.
Simultaneously? Or like two different scenes are supposed to be happening at the same time?
Kind of, or like two different shots that are just like covering the same moment.
Uh-huh.
Or multiple shots covering like the same moment. That's not necessarily, it's not pushing anything forward. It's just like exploring that moment. Like, there was a similar thing that happened in Ghost in a Shell, the animated movie that we discussed.
Yep.
Where there are these shots of the city and that are just,
oh,
it's not moving the plot forward. It's just shots of the city.
Right.
And it creates this ambiance of, like, this is what's going on. It's not moving forward, but this is what's going on. This is what's around them.
And that's the thing that you find in Japanese media.
Yes, a lot of mostly Japanese. But here you have the shot looking up at the sky from the point of view of the coffin, and they keep cutting back to the face of the guy in the coffin. And it's very clear what's happening. You know, but it's like very inventive camera work.
It is, you know, a little confusing because you get he's like sitting on a park bench, and then he becomes a ghost, and then that ghost goes and finds himself in a coffin, and then it just goes from the coffin bit.
That's like the scene of the movie, the highlight of the entire experience of watching this movie, is the scene which turns out to be a dream sequence where he's put in this coffin and carried along to assumably be buried, but that doesn't happen in the film. It seems like that would be the natural progression, right?
Now, is the idea that like he's dead in that, or is it almost like a voodoo thing where he's just near dead and he's just immobile and can't move? Well,
yes, the second one. It's not that he's dead. It's that he's, well, you know, he's having this dream where he's like paralyzed. He can't move.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know why what's happening in the story that's significant to why this is happening to him. That's where the film sort of loses me, because it's like, it has all these interesting stuff going on, but I'm like, I struggle to like dissect the film to derive meaning from what is going on. Why is this character having this dream sequence?
Is this before or after the attempted poisoning?
This is after the attempted poisoning.
Okay, does he already have a suspicion as to who the murderer is?
Right, and that's another thing, that there's a murderer and a vampire in this story.
I'm just wondering if, like, he just gets this premonition about who the murderer is through this thing. Because that's what you see. It's like that guy puts him in the coffin, and you can see him lighting a candle through the glass, which I thought was kind of cool.
And the face of the old woman who's the vampire,
yeah,
like, looms over the glass. As he's looking out the window in the coffin, mm-hmm. he sees through the glass all these faces, and then they pick him up, and they're carrying him along.
So, like, this is... experience gives him the information to find out who both our murderers are.
And this brings up a whole nother issue, that the... what is happening in this film?
You gotta sit and think about it.
Yeah, it's not immediately clear. It's almost a silent film without subtitles.
Yes, and it's very surreal because, again, it is kind of it kind of moves between scenes in a very dreamlike fashion. But then you'll have a moment that is very standard cinematic kind of a thing.
But at large chunks of this film, it's, you know, because it's also in German. This is a foreign film. It's the spoken language is German. Theodore Carl Dreyer is a
Carl
director. He's from...
You're getting big stuff.
He's from Denmark.
Okay.
Yeah. Carl Theodore Dreyer. He's a Danish director. He's the most famous Danish director, you know. And his films did tend to focus on... tended to be very slow and focus on people with very intense or obsessive feelings about something, you know. Like, Passion of Joan of Arc, there's, of course, tons of religious symbolism, you know, like obsessive religious symbolism, you know. Whereas, like, here, it's a guy who's getting more and more interested in this, in vampires, you know.
I'm trying to figure out what his whole role in this movie was, because he just kind of shows up at this manor to stay the night. I guess it's also an inn. And then I don't even know where, like, the vampire part really comes in. And the owner of the manor at one point comes in, writes a note on a package next to the dude, and then he leaves while he's laying in bed.
And then he's murdered. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was trying to think about how to explain how this film starts, and I came up jokingly with the response that it's a film in which H.P. Lovecraft goes and stays at a hotel, and then FDR sneaks into his room in the middle of the night, warns him there's trouble going on, and then is killed by Einstein.
Yeah, I think that about covers it.
You gotta laugh at, like, some of the characters that, like, just show up in this film. And again, it's very strange. It's like, why are these people here? I don't even know if there's one woman or two women who look very much alike. Like, I don't know.
You know about the sick one that's under the spell of a vampire.
Right, and then isn't there another one?
Is the murderer, like, in cahoots with the vampire?
No, it doesn't seem like it, does it?
But why is he trying to get the girl to kill herself?
I have no idea.
That's the only thing
I don't
think
know
of.
What's happening in this film. Why is Einstein killing anyone here?
I don't know. And the peg-legged fiddler dies at some point for some reason.
Yeah, it seems like he was working with Einstein. Again, there's nope.
Was he?
I guess so. Or maybe not. It's very hard to tell. I've seen this
movie.
Oh,
and he had the guy with, like, the fez.
Who looked like Popeye.
No, I think that was just a guy that showed up for a brief moment, wasn't he?
I don't know. There was a guy who was very squinty. I thought it was it was the guy with the fez.
I don't know.
It's so strange. it's very hard to decipher what is happening in this because it's all so dreamlike. And it's, the film doesn't, it feels like there's exposition while you're watching it, but then you stop and you think, well, wait a minute, what's going on? You don't know!
There were like blocks of text too.
Those were mostly, you know, someone would, it would just cut to a shot of somebody like walking into a room and picking up a book, and they would cut to text explaining vampire mythology. And then you'd be back to like this old lady wandering around in dark corners and lots of dancing shadows on the walls. Sometimes the shadows were moving backwards. This film seemed like a big experiment. It's so hard to discern a story from there. It's like, who is the main character? Why is the main character there? Is he just there to be the outsider? Sometimes that happens in stories where there's a character who's just, especially mysteries, there's a character who exists just to be the outsider, to discover all this exposition, you know, to be the eyes of the audience, to like, you know, who walks into a situation and goes, what's going on here, right?
Like a detective type character?
Yeah, so like that role is fulfilled by detectives mostly, but not always a detective. Sometimes it's just somebody who is an outsider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's, I believe, most prominently done that way in the detective genre. But yeah, to try to give you a summation of what this story is about, a guy shows up at an inn and finds out that there's both a murderer and a vampire going around. There's a sick girl who's being attacked by the vampire, and she's being taken care of by this doctor who turns out to be the murderer. And the people that just live in this little town are just trying to find out where the vampire is and find out who the murderer is.
Didn't you also at some point, though, describe the murderer guy as like a Van Helsing type character trying to kill the vampire? Is the guy just thinking other people are... Is he like the guy just mistakenly picking people out to be vampires and killing them?
Like, is there a vampire at all in the story? Is there just a murderer who's using vampire mythology to cover his tracks?
Well, I mean, you did have the old lady that they found in the coffin that was wandering about, and when they stabbed her in the chest, that girl got better.
So it's like, did it start with a vampire, and then the vampire, then this vampire hunter showed up, you know, like Van Helsing shows up, and then the vampire gets Van Helsing. You know, it's like Van Helsing becomes Renfield. You know who Renfield is, right?
Maybe.
Okay, you know, vampires can, like, hypnotize people and control them.
Yeah.
Renfield is the guy, he's usually seen in an asylum in these old vampire films.
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy who's under Dracula's spell, who eats bugs and stuff. So it's like, by the way, it's absolutely clear to anyone who's read Bram Stoker's... Bram Stoker. I've read the book twice. I can't remember how to pronounce the guy's name. I have the same problem with... Is it Rod Serling or Rod Sterling of The Twilight Zone? I don't know. I keep running into that problem. But anyways, I digress. It's clear they read Bram Stoker's Dracula before making this film. There's so many elements that are used, but they're not used as a direct adaptation. He completely does his own thing with the material that's presented in the novel Dracula. So it's very different from what happened with Nosferatu, where it's like all they did was make a film adaptation of Dracula and change the names. They also did some original stuff in that movie as well.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it's 90% Dracula the novel.
Which one do you think is a better film?
Vampire or Nosferatu?
Yeah.
I prefer Nosferatu. It's much more straightforward, and it's, for one thing, about what's going on in that movie. The cinematography isn't as inventive, but it's very well executed. F.W. Murnau was a brilliant director and cinematographer. His best film is called Sunrise. still an amazing visual piece. And considered, again, one of the most beautiful films ever made. The silent filmmakers, because of necessity more than anything, were extremely inventive. And there's stuff that's like, it's amazing to watch films for the most part nowadays and think, why don't they still use this? This looks interesting. Why don't they still do this? The only one of the, with one of the notable exceptions is Wes Anderson. He is absolutely influenced by the cinematography and the motion of, you know, silent films. Mm-hmm. You know, you sit down and watch a Wes Anderson film and you're looking at it, it's like, man, I've never seen a film that looks like this. Well, then you probably haven't seen a Buster Keaton film either.
It does have an older flavor to it.
That puts me in a tough spot, you know, picking between... obviously, I have the luxury of not having to choose. I can watch both of them.
At the same time.
Yep. Two different screens. That would be an interesting experiment.
It would be a good double feature.
But the truth is, despite having similar source material, or that's the same source material, who am I saying? Like Nosferatu and Vampire, again, they're both German too, and they're both pretty much silent films. There is a minor sound element to Vampire, but it's really underutilized. It's really, this is pretty much a silent film where you occasionally hear somebody say something or you hear a sound. But I think if they had a fully integrated, like, sound element, that this film could be even better than it is. You know, imagine, like, these visuals with interesting sound design. You know, think of, like, a mm-hmm. cartoon, all the little sound. And obviously, horror, you have all the sounds of horror. You know, they sell tapes that are just sounds of horror. Where it's like doors creaking and stuff. Like, if they were able to integrate that element, you know, the door farts, you know.
Was that just all a setup?
That was the slowest burn joke. No. The second you said door farts, I thought of, like, the sound effects element. And I thought of this whole conversation that I needed to get to this point. I did. I have to admit, I did think that. I'm that sick of a person that I did think that through.
Thanks, Jellyheads, for listening to this episode of Know Your Turns at the Drive-In. Where you've been your host, Lucas. And this was Dave. You can find us.
But the main difference, I would say, what makes Nosferatu and Vampire apples and oranges is that the way I feel after watching them is very different. Watching Nosferatu, that movie is eerie. It's extremely eerie. And there's also a sadness to it. Because, you know, you're definitely dealing with elements of this is, you know, dealing with the plague, you know, mass disease, and there's this whole, like, funerary tone to it, and Count Orlok is so creepy, just so creepy.
Creepy.
And then the cinematography is gorgeous, you know, and absolutely pitch perfect. Here, it's very much dealing with a feeling of, like, there's an element of, like, you're watching an illusion, not necessarily a magician's trick, but you're watching an illusion, a dream, a nightmare. It has an element of the fantastic, of almost the dark fantasy, an element of whimsy almost to it that is completely absent in Nosferatu. You know, when you see the shadows on the wall dancing and they're like sped up, you know. See, he follows the one shadow as it walks away and sits down in the place where it should be cast by the person sitting down. You know, it's like a person sitting there and his shadow walks up and sits down into the position that, so it's properly cast at that point. There's an element of fun, an element of whimsy in that. That's, you don't get that in Nosferatu. And whereas I'd say, you know, Nosferatu directly influences things that came later. You know, obviously the Universal horror pictures like Dracula and Frankenstein. But, you know, we like project forward, project to the modern day. You get Tim Burton, you get Guillermo del Toro, that sort of style, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can draw it back to Nosferatu in some ways. Carl Theodore Dreyer and Vampyr, you'd have to look at somebody like David Lynch to see where that inspiration follows. It's a much more Lynch-like aesthetic.
Yeah.
Or the people who make those like incredibly dark and surreal films. Because this is very surrealist. I mean, honestly, this is closer to Unchained Andalou than...
Who?
To the Unchained Andalou, I believe. I don't know. It's not English. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. But it's the film that Salvador Dali made where it's the, you know, the razor slicing through the eyeball. You've seen it. He didn't do it for real. It's a trick.
I know. It's still there.
But it's like, this is closer to that than it is to Nosferatu.
Which is too bad. I'd like to see more surreal elements in horror. I think it could lend an interesting aspect to it.
Yeah, and I'm always surprised by, in certain circumstances, the lack of imagination that is present in certain horror films where the opportunity is extremely present. Now, obviously, you've got a slasher. Those are very straightforward, and I don't blame them for not being more imaginative. You know what I mean? It's like they are what they are. You know?
But
like Popeye going, I am what I am. Yes. But you have things like
these ghost and demon, you know, films. They've been boiled down to such like an unimaginative formula, but like these things are otherworld creatures that should be able to manipulate your perception of reality.
Of course. And here's one that has one foot in the slasher and one foot in the other in the fantastic, and that's Freddy Krueger, the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Yeah.
Sometimes it does use its imaginative elements to great effect. I mean, the surreal ways in which Freddy Krueger dispatches with his... You have a girl who's obsessed with, like, just sitting and watching the TV. Like, they can't pull her away from the TV. Freddy Krueger becomes the TV, smashes her face into the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Freddy Krueger does twist reality, but then he does it on a very straightforward level, you know. It's like, they don't play too much with the surrealism of when you're in the dream and when you're not, especially in the sequels, I find. I think the highlights of the series are the ones that do it best, of course. But for the most part, it's like, all right, we know we're in a dream now because now everything's blue. It's like Freddy versus Jason, you know. It's like every time you're in a dream sequence, it's very clearly a dream sequence. You know, you don't have to question it. It's like they telegraph everything because they're playing to very low audience expectations, I feel, in that film particularly. I'm not a fan of that film.
That's tough because, you know, you're not hard to make a surreal horror film that's really going to feel that disorienting and make money.
Oh, yeah.
But I feel like it should still happen.
You can still have the commercial appeal and have the creativity to create a sequence or two in a film that goes beyond the pale of the what the is, you know.
You can still keep
that goes to that surreal place.
Yeah, you can still keep the linear storytelling, but at least challenge my perception of, you know, up and down.
To me, the first Nightmare on Elm Street does it best in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. The two instances to come to mind are like when you first see Freddy Krueger and his arms stretch out in that weird way. It's obviously a cheap effect, but the first time you see it, it's like, whoa, what's going on here? And the time that does it better is when the girl falls asleep at school, like in the middle of class, and she has this dream about her dead friend, and you know, you have the dead friend in the body bag, looking a lot like Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks, actually. You have the dead friend in the body bag, and you know, the leg of the body bag kicks up and gets dragged, like somebody's picked it up and and pulled it along, but there's nobody there. And then the body bag opens and you see the face of the dead girl, and a centipede crawls out of her mouth, right? Stuff like that where you're just like, we've entered another dimension, and I don't know, that sense that anything is possible. Like when I first watched Evil Dead 1 and 2, you know, the original and the amazingly hilarious remake sequel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was that sense that anything could happen. These things were not bound by any rules of reality. It's also that distortion of reality is what, when I was a kid, freaked me out when I saw the TV movie It. It wasn't that it was a scary clown, which it is. It's a scary-ass clown. But, like, I see a scary clown, I can run away. This thing can come up through the drain pipes. It distorts reality. You can't run from that. You can't fight back against that. You're fucked. That thing's coming after you. You're done.
Unless you willingly change your perception of reality. That's how they defeat the monster, but...
Yeah, they come up with a device that allows them to defeat it. In a practical sense, no, you're screwed if you come up against Pennywise. And that's what freaked me out. It was like, by the way, I never was able to finish the movie as a kid, so I never knew how they defeated it, so it made it all the more unnerving to me.
Well, it was a miniseries, Dave, so it was a little longer than one movie.
Right. And I never finished it. Yeah. I couldn't get through it because I was too scared.
A coworker of mine said the same thing. He saw it when he was like 6. I'm like, geez, who let you watch that at that age?
Yeah, I want to say I was a little older, maybe 8 or even 9, but I definitely saw part of it when I shouldn't have. You know, it was on TV and I just caught part of it. And then I think may have gotten a little bit of in trouble for like watching. It's like, what are you watching? And like, I'm scared. Make it safe again. Put the cartoons back on.
It's another clown. No.
It's just flipping through the channel. It's a clown and everyone. Mom's like, we're turning off the TV. Let's go to the park. Go to the park. There's a clown. Dave was never right after that day. Could never even look at cotton candy again.
When he found out our friend Liz was a certified clown, he could never speak to her again.
Yeah, we're going to her wedding soon, you know. And unbeknownst to us, we show up and it's all clown themed.
No! She's like, all your... What is that one stock screen that's like on Aura Monsters?
It sounds like somebody like falling.
Yeah, like an.
Oh my gosh, we've gotten a little goofy off the rails here, haven't we?
But we, you know, we're exploring themes and things. We're talking about how it's a shame that people aren't pushing the envelope in horror like they should be, even though the tools are there.
Oh yeah, and because like early silent film, especially foreign silent film, you know, the amount of experimentation going on here. You know, it's not only is it early in the history of film, but it's also outside of a Hollywood system. Because even in the early silent films, the Hollywood system took a hold very quickly. It's surprising how quickly it became a commercial commercial enterprise.
Because, you know, maybe they realized, wow, we can make these for dirt cheap and get back 100 times what we spent.
Oh, yeah. It was an amazing return on your investment. And that's why film culture just exploded the way it did. And, you know, they came out with sound. It's like, you don't even have to be able to read to go to these things anymore. But why is that, going to that surreal place, satisfying? Like, what itch does that scratch?
I don't think it itches a scratch for everyone. It does for me. It's while I've gotten drawn towards surreal humor, because it's just like, yeah, this is challenging my perception of things, but making me laugh at the same time. I don't know what it is.
Or not even, like, I don't even know how you would describe them, because, they're not jokey jokes, but, like, in, say, Rick and Morty, whose popularity has taken off to the point where I'm just, like, in a store looking for new jeans, and there's some kids, like, doing Rick and Morty references, you know?
It's gotten too big, it's gotten too big!
Yeah. I know, I have that feeling that very hipsterish feeling of this thing that me and my friends were into, that's now everybody knows about it.
So then when you bring it up, you're like, oh, you're one of those Rick and Morty bros. And you're like, no, I promise I won't.
Or it's like, I'm just like hearing other people go, you don't know me. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, oh.
I was doing that 2 years ago.
Yeah. That's exactly the experience I had. I can't deny it. That is exactly the experience I had the other day. I was just, ugh.
This is my special thing.
But in that show, there will be, like, just some background thing that's, like, or something that just happens in a moment that is surreal and funny. Like, the perfect example is in the first episode where they're running from aliens, and Morty sneezes. And his snot comes out, forms into a person, that's running along with them, that ages quickly to an adult and then an old man and then dies. This is like, it's hilarious. Or in a more recent episode, I think it was the first episode of the new season, when the aliens are being driven off the planet, and up out of a sewer, you see some characters come that it's clear, it tells a whole story in like a second. That these guys have been living underground, like it's this resistance to the aliens. It's funny because you have to think about it.
I like that.
I mean, it's familiar. There's a ton of sources of, like, the underground, like, resistance sort of, like, mm-hmm. characters. So it's not like it's like, what's that? Why did that happen? It's like they pop out of the sewers and they're armed to the teeth. And it's like, it looks like they're from Escape from New York. And you're like, I immediately know what that is. I connect that to my cultural awareness of what that is. In a context where I wasn't expecting it, and the unexpectedness of it in that context made me laugh, because the creators of the show were able to play with my awareness and tell a joke by doing something small that they didn't have to explain, because they knew that I, as the viewer with my cultural awareness, would be able to fill in all the gaps mm-hmm. and make myself laugh by doing so. It's like, in that case, they didn't make me laugh. They just did this little thing. They had to know that the audience member would be there who would put together everything else, all the context of that, and make themselves laugh. You know, there's objectivity and subjectivity in art. And a surreal film really plays with the subjective experience of an objective experience of watching a movie. You know, you're watching a movie, you're seeing the same images everyone else is seeing. But your subjective experience of how you interpret that is completely different from person to person. And that's what a film like Vampyr does. It taps into dream logic that is a completely personal and subjective experience to everyone, and different to everyone. or if not completely different, unique to everyone, you know.
Couldn't have said it better, Dave. I like being able to put pieces together. It's just, you know, you almost feel like you figured something out that somebody hasn't. You're like looking around, you're just like, did you figure it out too?
Yeah, it's like when you have to put in the effort yourself, even if it happens in an instant in your head, you've done something, you've engaged, and once you've engaged, you have an appreciation. Like, music is very personal to me, and I have to get into music in a certain way, you know, for me to be able to... Somebody can't just, like, listen to this, isn't it great? And usually I'll just be like, well, without, you know, real... Like, I didn't get there myself. I didn't... Whereas music that I've sought out and I'm listening to, it's like, if I don't look for the music myself, I'm not going to have that deep level of appreciation for it.
Well, you get those, like... You know, you're showing a friend maybe like a show or a movie you really love, and there's just a part that, like, when you got it, you were like, whoa! And it hits that point with somebody else, and maybe they're like, they have no reaction, and you're just going like, aren't you?
Yeah.
Don't you get it?
Yes. I'm very aware of that feeling. I've experienced it many times.
So what? He's a dog. Yeah. But don't you remember when Tom said all dogs were lobsters? The world's a lobster.
I swear to God, I'm so tempted to just say that's a hell of a thing and end the show on that. The world's a lobster. That's a hell of a thing. Good night, gentlemen. Wait, what? What is happening?
Well, it can't be any more coherent than the titles of Last Coin. But I was just going to add on to that. It's like on the flip side, when your buddy or whoever does get it, and they turn to you, and you're like, whoa! And you're like both going, whoa!
That makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, or laughing uncontrollably at the same thing you got.
Oh, and back to the point we were making about films exploring surrealism. There was a very popular one called Inception.
Right.
That dealt... And I felt, when I went to see Inception, I was annoyed at how they kept explaining how things worked. It's like, I'm with you. I'm there. Just keep going. And yet, at the same time, so many people walked out of that film not knowing what the hell was going on. And I'm just like, I was bored because I was like, I get it, and they're not making me question what's real. It's like they cut between, you know, the first level of the dream, the second level of the dream, the third level of the dream, and reality, and I'm following them right along because they've explained it all. But it's not really making me feel like I'm in a dreamlike state. It's just doing things that are visually inventive and interesting. But I never got to that feeling of it feels like a dream. It feels surreal. That was a very straightforward dream logic. You know, it's like we're in a dream now and we can spin the room. You know, we'll have a spin room gunfight. Boom, boom. And I'm just like, that's so dumb. It's great. It's a great sequence, but it's so dumb. I mean, there's no real depth to Inception. It's just all there on the surface.
When people didn't understand it?
A lot of people still didn't understand it.
Well, those people won't understand anything, Dave.
Not a thing.
Their favorite movie will be someone pointing at a cat, go, cat. And then somebody points at a dog and goes, dog. This is a cat, this is a dog. And the movie's over.
Oscar.
I got it. There was a cat and a dog. I loved it. They told me what they were. I didn't have to think.
Well, hopefully anyone who listens to podcasts about movies likes to think about movies and are on the same level as us in that regard.
Did we lose you yet?
I totally recommend people should watch this. Understanding what it is, understanding that it's going to be dreamlike, it's going to be surreal. Don't look for a cohesive story here, because I've seen it twice and I can't put together exactly what's happening or why. And maybe that's a failure of perception on my part. Maybe I need to have some more context. You know, there's a new Criterion Blu-ray out. When I got this film, I read about it in a book, a film book, 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die. And I was in high school at this point and just starting to really become a cinephile.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this book, and I'm reading about these movies, and I'm like, how do I get copies of these movies? And this was pre-Amazon for me. It's hard to imagine that world now, isn't it? And I think I went on eBay and got a copy of this. It's a Criterion copy, but it's the DVD is just a transfer of their Laserdisc, and there's no menu. There's no menu at all. And then when the film ends, it immediately goes into playing some really creepy stop-motion animation stuff. I'm supposing it's a special feature, but I don't know what's going on. But it's interesting. But even though I don't fully understand what's going on in this movie, it's like the gothic flavoring, you know, that the element of the weird. And, you know, you see images like the skeleton hand holding the poison, the guy in the coffin, the shadows dancing. There's something even surreal about, like, when the murderer is found out and he breaks into this room and he finds the girl tied to a bed, which sounds weird, but there's nothing sexual in the imagery of it at all. In fact, there's something almost, like, weirdly religious, you know, like martyrish about the way she's like tied to this bed. It's really an excellently composed shot. This is like a person who's tied up, like about to be burned at a stake or something, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the impression you get. Not like deviantly tied up to the bed.
Just keep digging that hole, Dave.
Oh, I'm digging. I'm digging it. And I do, there's something that I like about that, all this stuff, all this, the weirdness of it, the things that I can't explain, but they're suggestive of something that, like, I felt once when I was dreaming. You know what I mean? There's something that's interesting. I don't know. If you listen to Pink Floyd, maybe check if you can dig that, you know, check out this film.
What he's trying to tell you, people, is it's weird, it's crazy, it's surreal. Go and watch it. Go enjoy it.
And that's a hell of a thing.
Well, Jilly folk, thanks for listening to this episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In. We're your hosts, Luke and
Dave.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. May we suggest you find this and other podcasts or website at psychojellyfish.com or whatever podcast app you happen to prefer. And if you're a fan, you want to help spread the madness, give us a like at facebook.com/psychojellyfish or follow us on Twitter at Jellycast. Any thoughts, words, comments, or questions, leave it to us. Tell us what you thought about Vampia. It's been a fun one, folks.
Good night, channel listeners.
Keep it psycho.
Deschlo's hair.
It's kind of like Castle Gentleman.
The Castle Gentleman.
A little more accurately, Lord of the Manor, but yeah, literally, that's what that says.
Castle Gentleman. I think, it sounds like something like people who really get deep into like BDSM, you know, it's like the Castle Gentleman is here. This is my dungeon. Pretty cool, huh? Remember that in What We Do in the Shadows?
Oh, yes.
He's just saying, this is my torture chamber. Pretty cool, eh?
Hey.